Welcome to Naturally Educated, the podcast from the Environment Agency Abu Dhabi. It's season 5, and we're looking this season at the role of biodiversity, technology, and sustainable practices in restoring degraded ecosystems. I'm Tim Elliott, and with me is Abdulrahman Alzaabi. How's it going?
It's going great, man. How about yourself?
Not too bad, thank you. All okay. We're kind of chasing each other all over the world for this season, talking to people all over the place, but I can hear you loud and clear. Abdulrahman, this episode, and I know you'll like this, the engineer in you is going to get something from this, I can tell. Technology meets nature in ecosystem restoration. So how might technology impact ecosystem restoration? You're well aware of the phrase, I guess, take nothing but pictures, leave nothing but footprints.
Oh, yeah, of course. It's something you see in the States, in particular, and on like trailheads, parks, and other natural areas.
That's exactly right. It's very much kind of a US kind of national parks phrase, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's more like a motto, really, to try to encourage environmental responsibility, particularly, you know, obviously when you're outdoor in parks. And it's a simple thing. It just means to leave natural areas as you found them, take just the memories, just leave your footprints behind. It's about minimizing our impact on the environment.
I mean, as much as we mean well in general, some of us might be a little heavy-handed and footed. when we venture out into nature, yeah.
I think you're right. I mean, the thing is that no matter how careful we are, there's only so much that we can do as people. There are only so many miles we can traverse when it comes to conservation and restoration. And the thing, you know, from that is that technology is providing some of the answers. I mean, you think of it this way. We're improving monitoring, analysis, intervention strategies. We've got tools like drones, AI, that phrase coming into the picture. Mm-hmm. Remote sensing can give us detailed data on ecosystem health. It can identify areas that need restoration, and it can optimize, you know, the allocation of resources to a particular area.
Indeed. So technology can do a whole lot more than an army of eco-warriors like yourself and myself could ever hope to do.
It's true, but it does start with us. Here's a couple of examples, right? Yeah. If you take bioremediation, we've heard that phrase a couple of times. And I think if we're honest, we're both a bit like, I don't know what that means. But I mean, I've looked it up. So that's when you use naturally occurring or deliberately introduced microorganisms to break down, say, environmental pollutants. So you can clean a polluted site using nature, fine. Or genomics, you know, the study of a complete set of DNA, for example. So both of those are being used to address specific restoration challenges. And that is happening right now.
So technology is just so important. It's honestly fascinating being an engineer, Tim, but it's often tough to break it down and to make it easy to understand.
It is. I mean, it's all very well for me to look up phrases and kind of regurgitate what they mean, but to really understand it and to get it across, we need someone who really knows their stuff to really break it down for you and me.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get to today's episode. Let's welcome our guest.
The right person to talk to, I think. Co-founder of a company who believe technology should serve ecosystems, not exploit them. That's kind of their tagline. Distant Imagery was formed in 2019 in Sharjah. They're kind of famous here in the UAE. Back in 2020, they engineered the first mangrove restoration drone. And I know that Mr. Abdulrahman Alzaabi, the weekend mangrove kayaker, will find that interesting.
My ears are perked up. I'm listening. but yeah, we'll find out more about what Distant Imagery does in a moment. But our guest is the company's strategic head, driving its scientific innovation, business strategy, and global impact. And her name is Jane Glavan. Jane, thanks for taking the time to talk to us and welcome to Naturally Educated.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here, honestly.
It's great to have you. Jane, let's start with who Jane is. Tell us more about yourself, your interests, and your expertise.
Yeah, great. I have the privilege of actually being in the UAE for the last 24 years. So it really helped define my career and who I am as a business owner, as an expert and professional, as well as a mom and everything else that I do. So I started actually at Environment Agency. I really lucked out in this incredible role as part of the Abu Dhabi Global Environment Data Initiative, or AGEDI, which was this incredible program with UNEP and talking around data and standards. But from there, we also got to do really incredible research. And part of that was blue carbon. So as part of my privileged career, I got to actually, you know, start that in the region. And that really grew my love of mangroves and salt marshes and seagrass and coastal areas. And from there, you know, as things go, sometimes there's budget cuts. And so but we needed to be innovative in the way that we could still maintain the same scope and integrity and everything else. So I actually started asking my husband, who I met here as well, he's a helicopter engineer, and to start building me things. Like, if you can build a helicopter from the ground up, you can build a drone or underwater 360. camera or whatever else. And so from there, we thought, this is a really great idea. And so that's how we started Distant Imagery about 5 years ago.
Wow. He sounds like a great engineer, by the way.
It's a lot of fun. You didn't set him off on anything. And he's like, can you do this? Actually, our whole mangrove restoration side was, I think, Amitha from EAD. She's like, oh, do you think you can do mangroves with drones? And we're like, maybe. And so we set Corey off, and 5 years later, we're here.
Wow.
And you're kind of known for, I mean, handy having an engineering brain in the household of a husband, I guess, but you're kind of best known for engineering the first mangrove restoration drone. You've kind of referred to it. Tell us about that, Jane, because I think it's fascinating. How does it work? What's involved? How have you, you know, scaled the enterprise? What's the story?
Yeah, it's been an incredible story, one that has been an adventure and still continues to be an adventure, always learning and evolving. Yeah, it really did. It started with, hey, do you think you can do this with a drone? And we quickly, first of all, we really have to understand mangrove, how it germinates, the natural qualities, the seeds, because there wasn't actually anyone in the UAE that we could find that really knew the whole process of germination. So the first actually 6 months of that story is Corey and I in the field in plus 40 degree heat, picking seeds on our own, dropping them, standing on ladders, trying to figure out how they fall and if we need a seed ball, the splat pattern, and we were growing mangroves in our garage, like all through our front area of our house and garage. And Corey was building the, at that time, building the drones in the garage as well. But really, it was about 6 months of understanding actual natural germination from the methodology perspective of what, because what we do is biomimicry, really. We're trying to understand nature and how mangroves naturally germinate. And then secondary to that is having a tool that is based on those seed characteristics, because they're soft, the seeds need to enter the soil, and all these different characteristics of how they naturally germinate that we need to enhance or modify with the drones so that they can get inserted in the soil in the right place at the right time. And so it was a lot of engineering from that first point of that rigging, using plastics from the site and creating 3D filament out of that, really engineering the drones to be longer and further out. And really, you'll see, like, through the evolution, this first design to where we are 5 years a day. Mm-hmm. We started with 2,000 seeds. We've upscaled to 5.5 million seeds last year.
Wow.
About 5 million. And really, it's that evolution of that rigging as well as the drones. We started using recycled wood and machine cutting the drones that we've engineered, everything in different ways, how we build the tanks and where are the tanks sitting, do the methodology in the field, has allowed us to progress. And this year, very, very excited, we'll be the first in the world to now use hybrid electric drones that we've self-engineered ourselves as well. So that will allow us, from a sustainability perspective, really enhance that side, as well as fly over 2.5 hours. And when you're planting seeds with drones. Really, it's not about, you know, going 7 minutes across a channel and spitting them all out in a clump, because that doesn't make sense ecologically. It's really about how far out you can get and getting in the sensitive areas and the hard to reach areas and everything else. Mm-hmm. And then finally, very finally, as actually now we're working with the Global South, and we're co-building with them. So we've taken these designs that we built here in the harshest conditions in the world and that we've proven successful. But now we're modifying those designs to what's available to the communities in the Global South and having them actually co-build. They physically build the drones themselves. They have 100% of revenue ownership of the use of the drones. But what we ask is that they share back their modifications back to us. And then we get better ourselves, because it's like testing our drones in every condition in the world, but also sharing those experiences and modifications with the other Global South communities that we work with. So Tonga is speaking with Kenya. Kenya is now speaking with Indonesia and sharing modifications as well as field modifications as well. So it becomes this global platform of real knowledge.
Great. I mean, I don't think I'm being biased here, but I think you picked the right tree in the UAE to be planting. It's the best one out there. But honestly, as an engineer myself, this is brilliant to hear. And I love the ethos behind it, where it's not only about, you know, improving the local environment here, but also sharing the technology overseas.
Yeah.
You know, I'm interested to know, how did you manage to scale up from a few thousand seeds to planting in the millions?
Yeah, it was really, it's both. It's from an engineering perspective of really understanding, and really the whole thing that makes us different and able to do that stuff is the self-engineering. It's the brains of the of the incredible people that we work with internally in Cori, that it's looking at really the seed characteristics and understanding that in the way that you're building both the drones for and engineering the actual tech as well as the rigging itself. That efficiency really helped us upscale. And because we're small and nimble and a little feisty, and you know, we started in our garage and now we're in a small warehouse still 10. Yeah, it's helped us be very nimble and not folder designs or to off-the-shelf platforms of drones or DJI drones or whatever it is that doesn't allow nimbleness, doesn't allow you to alter the rigging or the flight patterns or how long you're going out. And then the other side, I think, is this respect for nature and really taking true. When we monitor, we actually monitor every seedling there is. We account 100% of them, and it takes a really long time. But what that tells us is really this long-term learning of where it's successful and why it's not successful in other areas, more importantly. And it's like nuanced. It's like 1 meter is a, you know, 80% success rate, and a meter next to it is less than 20%. And why? Like, it looks the same. It looks, the soil looks the same. It looks relatively the same. So these micro nuances of what makes it successful or not is something that we're continuously trying to understand. And that comes with that is the long hours of figuring out, you know, and looking at where it is most successful and trying to understand those parameters around
it. It's just plain old hard work, isn't it? And using your brain. It's nice to hear drones being mentioned in a positive way. It's often a negative thing, isn't it? So that's kind of your background, Jane. Can we give the topic today a little bit of perspective here? Can I ask you more broadly about how technology and nature kind of blend, how they intersect in ecosystem restoration? In terms of tech solutions, specifically that support regeneration, what's the first thing that comes to mind? What's the standout tech innovation that is front and center for you? Is it drones, or is there something else that's going to be coming?
I think it's actually not quite the drone itself, because there's only so many ways. I mean, there's different materials to build the drones and things like that. And there's only so many ways you can design a quadcopter or whatever it is. But what I think is most interesting is the energy sources behind the drones, allowing you to have, because it's always this balance, this fine dance of how far you can get out with how much payload you have. And so you want to make it, if you have a smaller seed amount, that, you know, you can use different batteries if you have a larger one. So it's always this balance of how much are you carrying to how far you're going out and how long those planting patterns can take. And what that will change is the energy side of it. So more, and there's really cool new fuels coming out. There's really cool new solar side of it. And so solar printing directly on the drones. Like I said, we have hydrogen fuel cell drones that we're building now as well, but those are big. And so, like, we're talking about 4 or 5 tables big of drones. Wow. So, you know, literally, that's really hard. So when hydrogen fuel cells come smaller and more manageable and, you know, smaller in price, that's incredible. And then the sensors and the things that, like, it's, the drone is just a carrier. It really is. It's this, you know, you could do the same from a helicopter as you could from a kite. You could do the same from a tethered balloon. You can do, it's just a mechanism of the air that allows you to be more efficient. But it's the things that you do with the drone. And that's the exciting parts where, you know, sensors, LiDARs come down, these smaller LiDARs that are much lighter to carry with drones. That changes the whole face of species monitoring and habitat monitoring and biomass accumulation and things like that. Or, you know, these incredible sensors that are advancing and are integrating AI further and further, but also becoming smaller and smaller, as well as more cost efficient. And then honestly, I think we're going to go back. It's going to be really cool. I think we're going to start, there's going to be this advancing side that's always kind of there with very high expensive tech. Mm-hmm. But I think, as honestly, as climate change really impacts so much more of the populations around the world, we're going to have more and more people on the ground actually doing the work and restoring at scale or surveilling or whatever it is, that I think we're going to step back and it's going to be a really cool mix of, like, older kind of tech, like really nimble, quick FPV style drones that people are building in their backyards, combine, or kites or balloons, but combining that with newest sensors that are out there that are super lightweight and things like that. I think it's going to be this merge of both worlds that's going to be really, really exciting.
So Jane, how about some of the other forms of technology helping us to give something back to the natural world? I'm talking satellite imaging, remote sensing. What can these two offer?
Yeah, it's always when you're looking, especially from an environmental perspective, even at the local scale, it's not, especially marine areas like mangrove areas or coastal areas, as you well know yourself, right? That it's really, it's not this localized impact. You really have to look at the wider picture to really understand. You know, you can do something very small in your area, but then the next day, large scale dredging goes through a larger area, or there is something significant at a regional level that is occurring, or there is impact from climate change at the wider levels. So that really, that nestled approach, you know, when you're looking at the satellites, incredibly useful for high quality data and resolutions that are fit for purpose, which is great. You know, you can go from that 30 centimeter widely available satellite imagery, get that larger context, because that is so critical in a really marine environment where everything's so interconnected, and then have the drones go at that, you know, 1.5 centimeter, less than 1 centimeter resolution to really hone in on areas and see and really get data gathered at a different level. So that blended approach, that nestled approach, is so exciting as well. And as satellites come on the market, and especially UAE has done a lot around satellite imagery as well, it's really exciting to see that blend. I think will keep on increasing as well.
What about AI, Jane, artificial intelligence? We're all kind of, we're being bombarded with it. It's a buzz phrase. It's in my new phone. It keeps trying to tell me what to write in Microsoft Word, all sorts of things. But we're getting to a point, aren't we, where AI is actual intelligence. It's not just machine learning now. But how is AI contributing to restoring ecosystem health?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible, right? Like, I can speak currently around, you know, mixing multispectral analysis to understand health of a large scale area, but then really defining that through ground spectrometry and things like that. So you really get specific signatures off specific plants. And there's so many things you can do from an AI perspective. We integrate it in our drones so that when the drones are flying, they're much more efficient in the way that they're flying, as well as the pattern that they're flying. We use AI more machine learning side around success rates and understanding, because as I was saying, it takes a long time to walk and count 5.5 million without compacting the earth and everything we're trying to not do with, you know, so it takes a long time. So having success rate monitoring is something that we've built a platform around that and just finalizing, as well as interconnected systems, like looking at behaviors of dugongs and seagrass, and then connecting that science to, you know, the mangrove science, because it's all, again, interconnected. What happens in the seagrass also happens in the mangrove areas. So it's very cool that way, but I cannot wait for the future, because can you imagine, you know, right now I spend 2 months doing data collection. So I go out high and low tides and I figure out soils and depths and blah, 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 and put it all together. And then I use my brain and and Corey's brain, and we figure out the best planting patterns, and from there then we'll fly it autonomously from those patterns. But can you imagine if, like, and this is something we're trying to develop over the next couple of years, is as it's flying, as we have a lady fleet, they're all women, they're very hardworking, all our drones, and so our drone women fleet, they all have names, Helga, Astrid. Can you imagine when Helga's running out there and she's actually has AI analytics on board and it's making decisions live as where are, so it's taking in the data as she's flying. She's figuring out the depth and the height and all the different, you know, learning that we've been doing around trying to figure out what makes it successful. As it's flying, it's actually doing those decisions and planting in those patterns. And then after, when you're doing the monitoring, it can actually, rather than, again, Jane and Corey looking at the dugong data and we're looking at seagrass and we're looking at the corals and looking at the interconnectedness of the systems and trying to figure it all out, AI will be able to do that for us and become really intelligent in the way that we look at both monitoring and success and upscaling actual ecosystem services and the actual forests themselves. It's just incredible. But humans have a key part of all of that. It's definitely not replacing any kind of human intelligence. It's taking it and amplifying it so that we can be much more smart and efficient in how we're doing the restoration.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of technology in general, but AI always blows my mind. It's like a little investigator that you just tell it what you want and then it comes back with an amazing, precise answer.
Yeah, it's a little scary sometimes.
That too, of course.
When you start doing the other kind of generative.
Yeah.
About your personality and things like that.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. No, it's an incredible tool.
Of course. Yeah. You know, another aspect of technology is biotechnology, genetic engineering, genomics. These are all big areas. But from your perspective, I would like to know, where are we seeing contribution and advances in these areas?
So, and forgive me if this is not the answer you'd like.
Whatever comes to mind.
I see a lot out there and it's incredible work and progress. And I think it adds a layer of data and proving what we know already. So I think that's interesting. And there's an evolution to it that I think will be interesting as well as it further advances and identifying again, where are the successful areas and what makes success right or where it's not successful and things like that. But I also have to say at the same breath, is that I think often that there's a knowledge that we aren't giving as much credibility to. And so very honestly, when we're going out restoring, yes, we do all the, you know, we do less than 1 centimeter data collection and we do everything that I just said. But at the same time, what we're really also looking at is that it's the knowledge that you get from just working in that indigenous knowledge, the localized knowledge, the so many different terms. But that, you know, those new sciences that you just mentioned, that is intuitive in the way that you smell the seed, you feel the seed, you look at the ground, you look at the soil, you feel the soil. The way we restore is looking at crab holes and following crab hole lines or things like that. Like, there is definitely this place for that type of science, but I think what it's doing is validating indigenous knowledge that already knows the answers to those questions. Mm. If that sense. And that's, yeah, I think it's a little different take on it, but it's how I know in my working with the communities in the Global South and working myself when we're out there, that knowledge is way more powerful than me looking at a satellite image or a map. It's that combined with the other type of knowledge that helps justify that.
It's interesting that, because we've heard that so many times when we put this podcast together. It's about talking to local communities, talking to fishermen, understanding where fish populations have decreased or have grown. It is exactly that indigenous knowledge. Can I ask you, Jane, for something that we've heard? It's a phrase we've heard quite a lot through this season, and I think you're the person to really explain what this means. Predictive ecosystem monitoring and real-time data collection. Now, on the top of that, I understand, kinda, but can you put that in simple terms so that we get a picture of just how much technology's moved the needle in terms of the monitoring and in terms of the data collection?
Yeah, it's just, again, it's this ability now where we are with analytics and software and AI, where we can look into the future and understand this interconnectedness that's very difficult for us to just look at, that complexity of a marine environment or a complexity of a coastal environment. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to look into the future when there's so many interrelated data points or interrelated understandings of what is going to take place in that sense. So predictive analytics around success rates is really understanding where it is today and looking at the best way to accomplish success in a way that understands the habitat as a whole system, rather than just you're looking at your mangrove seed and trying to figure out where it's the best place. You're looking at it from a systemic perspective.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of statistics happens in the background, collecting all this data, analyzing, etc.
Yeah. Again, or you can just look at those high ledge lines and look at the landscape and see where the trees are growing higher or lower and looking at successful areas.
There you go.
There is still, again, it's a interpretation and it's a Western science acknowledgement of what indigenous knowledge does at the same time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a reason why specific regions grow in this specific way for thousands, maybe millions of years. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that predictive analysis and looking at the future of, or looking at where, you know, best to restore or where to be most successful in the future, and looking, you know, when you're talking about climate change and impacts and dredging channels, and you're looking at sea level rise, and you're looking at holistic change of the environment and temperature and salinity and everything else, that is a lot of information to take, right? So it's helpful towards seeing what you see and creating it even into the future in a way that our human brains can't quite put together currently. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of restoration, one topic that comes up as well is soil degradation.
Yeah.
And we need to mention the restoration of soil through technology, specifically precision agriculture, which, you know, we would like to hear more about. So tell us, you know, what are the contribution of these technologies to the ecosystem restoration?
I'm limited with agricultural regeneration But I do know that with the use of drones and the sensors particularly, again, the drone is just a tool to be able to have observance from the sky. But the sensors that are out there and the ability to do analytics on temperature and soil moisture and predictive, that's where I think it's interesting, mm-hmm. that predictive analysis about crop rotations and the placement of the crops and the soil characteristics and everything else that goes with some of these sensors that are able to pick that up where the human eye cannot. I think that's where really all this predictive analysis is incredible, is because we can't see it with the naked eye, a lot of this. And from a soils perspective, as well as looking at nutrient bases, it looks at pollutants. EAD did an incredible with drones project around looking at pollutants in the soil at a level that has been unseen yet. It was a really great project for me and D around that as well. And so, yeah, I think it all comes down to incredible sensors mixed with the increase of AI intelligence and being able to do more holistic analysis.
Jane, you talked earlier about distant imagery, and one of the things that you've been able to do from here in the UAE is connect with Kenya and connect with Indonesia, and you kind of grow that global platform. And it strikes me that one of the things that that we've been talking about today is, in terms of real world technology examples, is we now have the online world. You know, we've got these platforms. We can share data. We can be open about data. We can work collaboratively and we can work globally. And that's the one thing, isn't it? You've got this indigenous knowledge. We know what grows here. We know what works here. We know what doesn't work here. We can share that in seconds. Yeah. It's incredible.
It is incredible. It's absolutely. And there's this passion to do so because, mm-hmm. you know, for the global south, it's a matter of life or death often, right? Mm-hmm. It's I'm sure you've seen Tuvalu has started its first migration because of sea level rise.
Yeah.
Into that this. It's not just from interest in trying to, you know, amplify or this and that. It's critical to their absolute survival. So they are absolutely interested and keen and excited to be able to share and learn from other communities that are both in different conditions, because they see that as a potential future for what their conditions will look like, or just being able to understand what others are doing, because there might be some kind of avenue or asset or some kind of stream of information that they haven't learned yet. And so because everybody does do it slightly different from each other, so figuring out those has been, and talking to each other in real world and being able to share data or share their modifications on a platform or speak to each other and come to each other's sites has been really exciting and actual, like, real world impact.
So this episode is all about technologies increasing a pivotal role in ecosystem restoration. We've looked at what technology offers and what we've tried to break down how technology has a very real effect on ecosystem restoration. So this effort is kind of multifaceted. You're doing a lot of things at once, and sort of, you know, the scale of the issues and problems that we deal with needs that kind of approach. So much is happening, far more than when we have time here to discuss here in this episode, unfortunately. However, we have one last question. From your perspective, can you put into words the importance of the steps the UAE is taking to embrace technology in harmony with nature, to rebuild ecosystems, enhance biodiversity, mitigate climate change, and create a sustainable future?
Yeah, I mean, it's so, especially as I travel internationally, you really see the differences with UAE and the incredible enabling atmosphere and infrastructure that it provides to people. It's really this amazing, incredible place where there is this love of trying the new and taking the risks and being able to look at things in new ways, as well as still respect culture and heritage and everything else, this combination of both. And so I think really what stands out is, from a policy framework, that having commitments, these large-scale net zero commitments, having 100 million mangrove commitments, having these, you know, really sometimes very hugely scaled, but it gives this It gives incentives to the private sector as well as the financial sector to be able to invest, because it's a strong signal that this is the way the country is going and this is what's being supported. And so that allows for CSR budgets to open. It allows for project financing to open. It allows for enabling policies and frameworks around what we're trying to do as entrepreneurs, as well as, you know, really academics and everybody else that's trying to really make an impact with climate change, that those policy setting is really where it begins. And then also having like EAD with its ADMI infrastructure as well, you know, going out, being able to have reporting and NOCs, and there's some kind of overlook of the system and looking at the monitoring data. That's incredibly helpful out there because it really gives the legitimacy to being able to access land. It gives, you know, the security for project financiers to be able to understand there's longevity to their project investment, that there is some overlook as well. So, you know, those kind of both sides, the policy framework as well as the enabling kind of on the ground implementation, you know, accelerators like ADMI really are supportive of the whole growth of, yeah, and climate tech.
Jane Glavin is the co-founder of the UAE-based Distant Imagery. Jane, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you for joining us on Naturally Educated.
Thank you.
And that's our technology episode this season, season 5 of Naturally Educated.
Indeed it is, Abdurrahman. Technology meets nature and ecosystem restoration. And it's amazing what's happening. Moreover, it's amazing what's happening on our doorstep here in the UAE. As always, can I just say a huge thank you once again to our guest, Jane Glavin, co-founder, Distant Imagery.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Jane. It is so, so interesting. I have to say, Tim, as an engineer, I keep saying this over and over, but you don't understand how impressive technology is from the basics of it. Mm. But I don't know, it's mind-blowing. The importance of technology in quite literally everything we do, and an area that will be in a major part of the discussion at the IUCN World Conservation Congress in Abu Dhabi this October as well. Mm-hmm. You know what, Tim? I feel like today really only scratched the surface of what technology offers the natural world. As we often say, there's just so much more to discuss. But there's something I'll really take away from today's conversation, and that is the fact that you can precisely sort of engineer this drone and tell it where to go and where to plant the seed at the specific, you know, force.
Yeah.
It's just impressive to me.
It really is. And then what Jane mentioned, I mean, from engineering the drones from the ground up, if that's even the right phrase for a drone, and then the new battery, the new source of power, and then bringing AI so you can target even more carefully. That was a real standout for me. The other thing that, you know, really stood out is she reinforced, you know, the fact that technology is hugely important. And it's great to share data, to manipulate, you know, the distance between people, to bring it down to being able to collaborate effectively, etc. But there is no substitute for local knowledge, indigenous populations, people who've worked the fields or the seas, who know the environment they're in. You can't find a better way than talking to somebody on the beach, a fisherman that's been there for 50 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's humbling to know that no matter how far and advanced you become, you still have to go back to the roots and understand, you know, the indigenous technology, the indigenous thought, let's say, and the knowledge. You know? Interesting and fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
Needless to say, I've learned something today, and that's really what Naturally Educated is all about.
I hope so. It's good to hear. That's our technology episode, season 5 of Naturally Educated from the Environment Agency, Abu Dhabi. I'm Tim Elliott.
And I'm Abdurrahman Al-Zaabi. Join us again for more on how to rebuild, restore, and protect our natural environment.